the 1st Infantry Division in Vietnam. Into a new kind of war come the men of the Big Red One. Far from the concepts of trench warfare and front lines of World Wars I and II, today's challenge in Vietnam demands quick assault and rapid mobility techniques. In this conflict, as in every other, the 1st Infantry Division is serving the United States with honor and distinction, no matter what the task, no matter what the sacrifice.
Few things in Vietnam which have the devastation of an artillery fire mission. Have a definite knowledge of their job, their gun, and their mission. PFC John W. Krim is such a man.
Well, I do most things. I can drive a 548, pull a lanyard, hump Joe's, drive track. Just anything I can do, I can do it.
Do you think artillery is a good thing to be in?
Well, yes, it is, because there's a lot of guys out there that's depending on our support to help them, and we know if we help them, they help us, and to keep Charlie away from us.
You have a lot of long hours in the night?
Well, some nights we get up far each night, maybe up 2 or 3 o'clock more, but that's just about all we do.
How long have you been over here?
Been here about 2.5 months.
Feel in 2.5 months you've been thoroughly educated with artillery?
Well, yes, because all the guys here, I took AIT as tank trainer. When I come here, I didn't know a thing about artillery or nothing. When I got here, all the guys pitched in together and they learned me everything I know about it now. And the sergeants and the lieutenants and things said that I made a good soldier.
Do you find the morale of the troops around here pretty high?
Oh, yeah, we manage to keep our morale up. We have guitars and things here, and we play music every once in a while, and basketball. We got a lot of sports here.
What happens when a mission is called in?
Well, when a mission is called in, we power shift our gun to the deflection that we're going to fire the Joes in. Say, if we had to fire 3,000 meters out, we'd have to power shift our gun to the direct, where the Joe would follow the direct deflection of our gun.
How accurate are they?
Our guns are accurate to the point. We fired, well, the first month I got here, we fired on a rocket bunker, and we hit right dead in the bunker.
How far was it away?
About 3.5 miles.
PFC David Droschman is a number two man of his gun. We ask him just what a number two man does.
All right, open and close the breech, pass it around this rim, they'll take the tray off and fire the piece when I have to close the breech after they bring it up, and I'll fire it on the command of the RTO.
Have you ever gotten used to the loud noise?
I'm just getting used to it now. It's pretty loud.
How long have you been over here, Dave?
Since September, about almost 4 months.
How many men comprise a battery?
Well, there should a full section of about 10 men, and we got 4 guns in this battery, be about 40 men. That's not counting the chief of smoke, FDC, and exec post. Could run into about 80 men just with a firing battery.
What do the different people do with 10 men on a gun?
Well, we've got the gunner. He sets the deflection, the direction of the round. The assistant gunner, he sets the range, how far out it'll go. Chief of section, he's in charge of everybody. He checks the gunner, the assistant gunner, and he's the one who works the controls to bring the Joe up to the tray, and he rams it. And then they have 2 men that hump the Joe over, bring it over, and hook it on. 2 men on powder, usually one to run it, one to cut it. We have 7 different charges, and 1 man on the phone, RTO. He gives us the information from the exec post out of the FDC.
You mentioned something about Joe. What's a Joe?
That's a projectile.
Do you enjoy your work?
Yes, I do.
Is there anything you'd rather be besides an artilleryman?
No, I don't think so.
What do you think of leadership in your battery?
I think it's very, very well. It's set up very good. Men who are in charge of us know what they're doing, and they don't push us or harass us or anything. It's real fine.
What do you do here during the day when you're not having a mission?
Well, we try to rebuild everything. Anything that starts to look shabby or gets worn down, we'll tear it down and rebuild it. Maintain the gun. Keep everything policed up. Try to keep it as nice as we can.
How closely do the artillery people work with the infantry as far as, say, the forward observer in an infantry company?
Well, there is a forward observer with every infantry company that goes out right with them on the front, out with them on the front lines. Plus, we have an aerial observer, an AO, a spotter plane above, and we 105 batteries would fire as close as 50 meters in front of the infantry. Well, we can fire, we wouldn't fire any closer than 200 because of the killing radius of the projectile.
I've heard that modern artillery today works with computers. Is this true?
Yes, it is true. They have, they used to do it, have one man plotting deflections and quadrants with a map, and now they can pick out the target and run it through a computer and get almost exact information. We can put the round anywhere we want.
How accurate is a round? How accurate can you fire it?
Well, we can fire it within 5 meters of a target.
Have you made a lot of friends?
Yes, I have. I think I made a friend out of everyone in the battery. Everyone gets along real well.
Working with each infantry company is an artillery forward observer. First Lieutenant Dennis Norris is a forward observer.
Well, when I first came to Vietnam about three and a half months ago, as your first job as an artilleryman, as a lieutenant, is to go out on the hill with an infantry company, and that's where you really get your feet on the ground.
Have you had real good cooperation with the 1st Infantry Division units in carrying out the missions that you call in?
Most definitely. Especially the infantry people, they really, really rely on the artillery.
Sergeant James Chivalot was once a professional football player with the Green Bay Packers. Like the rest of the men in his battery, the 8th and 6th Artillery, the dedication to his job is quite apparent. Sergeant Chivalot is interviewed by Army Specialist Dick Holleran.
Jim, could you tell us a little bit about your job here, what you're doing with the 8th of the 6th Artillery?
Well, I'm the chief of section here with the 5th Section, 155 Howitzer Split Trail.
Could you describe some of the responsibilities you have and the gun you work on, its capabilities here in Vietnam?
Well, we're basically an air mobile battery, and 155 artillery piece, so a range of about 14,000 meters, fires a 96-pound projectile. My job is to ensure that we don't fire any mistakes. Everything that goes out is correct. Check all the data. Make sure my men perform their jobs properly and well-trained.
Tell us some of the missions you fire here in Vietnam. I believe there are three of them. And the sources of information you get for the targets that you shoot at.
As a gun section, all our information comes down from FDC. They get their information from AFOs and FOs on the ground, infantry units calling in for support. We fire basically support for infantry contact, bunkers, preparation for infantry to come into an area, counter mortar, counter rocket, and the H and I harassing interdictory rounds.
Now, you once played college football for the Boston College Eagles, then went on to play with the Packers. Could you tell us a little bit about this, playing for Mr. Lombardi and the world champion Packers?
Well, Mr. Lombardi, as everyone calls him, you either call him Mr. Lombardi or Sir, you don't coach, you don't call him Vince, because he gets a little upset at that. And you don't want to upset him, because if you get him upset, he can make it difficult for you. It's bad enough playing under him as it is. I liked him as a coach. He was fair and hard, which is fine with me as far as being a coach.
Are they really as close-knit as everyone says?
Very close. Lombardi likes to use the word love. Members all pull together, help each other out. You know, very friendly.
It's a generally good atmosphere.
Now, you were the close-knit family in the Packers. What do you think of the 1st Division? Is it a good unit over here?
I'm real pleased with being in the 1st Division. I think it's a fine unit. It's got a great history. And real happy to be with them.
What are your plans when you get out of the service?
Well, I'd like to try and go back and play a little more football, see what happens. I don't know. It's a long way off from now.
From time to time, special guests visit the artillery batteries. Recently, the guests were small orphans from a nearby Vietnamese orphanage. Sergeant First Class Earl Bailey talks about the young visitors.
For quite some time, we have been in touch with these orphans. They are from Bencat. And from time to time, we take food and candy from the men down to them. And today, our first sergeant has made arrangements with the civilian personnel office and brigade and to get the permission to bring them out to the battery. And so we have them out here today to give them ice cream and refreshments and to let the men of the battery entertain them a little bit and show them what we have and to just to be with them for a while.
In appreciation, the orphans sang for the men. Artillery is the oldest unit in the Army. Originally known as Alexander Hamilton's Cannoneers, Delta Battery has been on active duty since 1775. But, long history or brief, the men of the big guns always display the special effort the division demands, duty first. From the 1st Infantry Division, this has been 1st Lieutenant Forrest Brandt and Army Specialist Bill Johansson.
First, the story of the 1st Infantry Division in Vietnam. Duty First, the presentation to the 1st Infantry Division Information Office in cooperation with the American Forces Vietnam Network. In Vietnam. Into a new kind of war come the men of the Big Red One. Far from the concepts of trench warfare and front lines of World Wars I and II, today's challenge in Vietnam demands quick assault and rapid mobility techniques. In this conflict, as in every other, the 1st Infantry Division is serving the United States with honor and distinction, no matter what the task, no matter what the sacrifice.
The first thing I thought was, I thought it would take a long time for it to get there. But actually, it took only a couple of minutes, and when I saw it coming in, it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
Well, you know, there I was, laying on the ground, not knowing whether I was going to live or die or not. And it was just something I can't describe when I looked up and saw this big, beautiful thing coming up to get me, because I knew this is my lifesaver, and I'll always be grateful.
Well, you know, I've always been told before I came over here that the dust offs got there immediately after a man was hit. Man, that's the way it was with me, as I was laying there, and it was actually the most beautiful sight in the world.
It was about a few minutes, it seemed like a few hours, and all of a sudden I looked up, and became a little old ship with the Red Cross on it. Maybe you feel a heck of a lot better knowing I was getting out.
I was kind of worried for a few moments there because I didn't know whether the dust off would be able to get through the enemy fire.
It's just a fantastic feeling to know that you're going to be evacuated so quick, that you're going to make it out of this place, that you're going to get back to safety, and someone's going to take care of you.
To a wounded soldier, the sight of a Huey dust off ship is indeed a welcome sight. The dust off concept began during the Korean War, but has come of age in Vietnam. It takes a special kind of man to fly in a dust-off crew, and many such men are found in the 57th Medical Detachment, which today celebrates its 7th year of service in Vietnam. The operations officer, Captain William Covington, tells of the history behind the 57th.
There is a lot of tradition by the original 57th dust-off. The term original has been designated simply because the 57th was the first medical evacuation detachment in Vietnam. It goes back to 1962 under the command of Major Charles Kelly. Today is our anniversary, which will be our 7th, and we take a lot of pride in the unit simply because we all like our work and we do have a fine tradition to uphold.
It's been said that dust-offs more or less go in and get them where they are. To what extent does the 57th follow this sort of a policy?
Well, I'd like to think that the patient on the ground has a lot to do with this. If the man is in bad shape and we know that he must be evacuated very quickly or he has a chance of losing his life or maybe losing a limb, then we kind of go on a 50-50 basis. We're very lucky in dust-off in that we carry just 4 crew members. We're able to fly the aircraft tactically and with the aid of the ground troops, finding out basically where the enemy is. We're able sometimes to slip in, slip out, undetected.
As a pilot, you get a chance to work with these crews quite closely. What kind of a feeling do you have for the men that work underneath you?
I can't say enough for the crew chief and the medic on our aircraft. These fellows work under, I would say, the most strenuous of conditions. And it's been my sightings that they've always come through in the greatest manner. The medic is in charge of the medical service to the individual. He constantly, when we're not flying, is attempting to teach his crew chief different methods of first aid and what have you. And the crew chiefs also play a big part in treating of the patient under the direction of our medical corpsman on board. They are just great.
From the time a mission is called until the wounded personnel are evacuated, only minutes pass. The mission you're about to hear serves to demonstrate the close coordination between the ground troops and the helicopter ambulance. Century 36 is the ground commander calling for medical assistance to Lyke Dustoff.
All Lyke Dustoff control, this is Century 36. I have a urgent medevac. Are you prepared to copy?
Century 36,
Lyke
Dustoff.
I'm prepared to copy. All Lyke Dustoff, Century 36. Coordinates are 3 miles east of checkpoint Charlie. I have 2 urgent litter and 3 urgent ambulatory. U.S. wounded in action. Call sign on the ground will be Century Fox on standard ground to air. LZ is secure and marked by smoke. All copy?
Century
36, this is Dustoff 75 with an ETA of 05 to 10.
The helicopter becomes airborne and, in short order, is hovering over the pickup area. Final landing preparations are made. Dustoff 75, the pickup ship, makes contact with Century Fox, the infantry coordinator on the ground.
Century Fox, Dustoff 75, over. Dustoff 75, Century Fox, go ahead.
Dustoff 75, we're about 0 minutes out of the clip. What is the tactical security of the area? And what is the last direction of contact?
Dustoff 75, Century Fox, roger. Our last contact was out to the west. Recommended direction of approach will be from east on a heading of about 260.
Dustoff 75, are you ready to pop the smoke? And how is it to fire?
Dustoff
two-thirds of the pilots are warrant officers. Mr. Sherman Goodman of the 57th talks about qualifying to become a dust-off pilot.
First qualification for most pilots is that they volunteer to fly dust-off. These pilots are, when they're in flight school, they put in their dream sheets to fly dust-off, and if they're lucky, they're sent to Fort Sam Houston for, I think it's 4 weeks of medical training, similar to what our medics do.
Is there a special sense of pride in being a dust-off pilot?
There is a special sense of pride. You're doing a special job, and I think the people on the ground appreciate it. They know what you're doing for them, how you're putting yourself out for them. They really appreciate it, and it gives you a good feeling to know that you're helping people rather than hurting them.
What sort of thoughts go through your mind when you're in the ship and you realize you've got that cargo in the back that's got to be landed in a hospital?
Well, the first thing, when you're in the ship, your mind's only on the flying. You think of nothing else. When you're going in to pick up the patient, you think about where the bad guys are, wind conditions, and trees and bushes and things like this. That's just about all your thoughts cover. And when you're taking the man back, then you can kind of relax and just fly him back to the hospital. Get him there as quick as you can, but the tension's over.
How important is the coordination between the ground commander and the aircraft commander?
Oh, this is real important. The ground commander has to bring the dust-off ship in. He has to inform him of the conditions in the LZ, where they took fire from, how much, what kind, and he more or less has to bring the ship in. He pops the smoke and tells the dust-off ship from which direction he should come in to avoid the VC.
The unsung hero of dust-off is the medic who flies along with the chopper. Spec 5 James Curtis tells about his duties as a flying medic.
Main job as a medic is, first of all, to go out to the field or the site of the pickup, pick the patient up on board, and then while in flight back to hospital, dispensary, aid station, is keep the patient alive, stop the bleeding, give them primary, basic medical treatment.
Now you go out on a mission. What is your job as a medic as soon as the chopper hits the ground?
My primary job before this is guiding the chopper down to a safe landing on the ground. The main thing, keeping the rotor blade clear and the tail rotor clear of all trees and obstacles so we don't crash. And as soon as we touch ground, whichever side the casualties come from, which is usually my side because the pilot or AC try to turn it towards, I try to sort the most critical wounded patients and put them on the chopper if we have more than our capacity to carry. The more critical gets on first because they need more medical aid. And we put them in the chopper any way we can if it's sort of hot, LC. And immediately upon loading, we get on board, chopper pulls pitch, takes off. And then my first job is to make sure the chopper gets back out of the LZ so we don't hit anything else. And as soon as we're clear at about 500 feet, I start treating the casualties, making sure that the bandages, there's no bleeding, they're breathing, they're all right, they're shock or nothing like this, all from a cigarette if they like smoking, something like this.
The crew chief's primary job is to maintain the aircraft. Spec 4 Bill Adamek came to Vietnam expecting to fly slicks, but ended up with the 57th, a change he now appreciates.
The crew chiefs are responsible for daily maintenance and both series of inspections you have to go through the time you're flying your aircraft. Also, we're responsible for helping medical corps and assisting the medication of patients and assisting pilots in locating various smokes or situations on ground. And during the day, while we're pulling on maintenance, we find maybe problems or problems that could be caused later on for grounding of the aircraft, which we try to prevent before the aircraft goes in the air. So really, we're the caretakers of the aircraft and medical helpers in the air.
Now, you mentioned being medical helpers. To what extent were you trained for this?
Well, our training at AIT wasn't very extensive at all. It's really mostly OJT over here, once you get over here, and maybe some at basic training. But I found myself giving artificial respiration to patients and patching up some wounds, and we find ourselves many times giving patients treatment right into the surgical operation room. We try our best to help, and we get all the information we can from the medics to help these patients.
How do you and the other crew chiefs feel about your job?
Well, we feel our job is very rewarding over here, helping people out in the field that are wounded, and we're very grateful that every night we come back, we have a bed to sleep on, and we take this into consideration that these people out here out in the field don't have this right every night. So when we go out there, we know that we're helping somebody, and just makes us feel a lot better at the end of the day.
Today we salute the men of the 57th Medical Detachment, the originals, who celebrate 7 years of service in Vietnam. Speaking for the 1st Infantry Division, this has been 1st Lieutenant Forrest Brandt and Army Specialist Bill Johansson.
Duty First, the day of the 1st Infantry Division in Vietnam. Duty First, a presentation to the 1st Infantry Division Information Office in cooperation with the American Forces Vietnam Network. Infantry Division in Vietnam. Into a new kind of war come the men of the Big Red One. Far from the concepts of trench warfare and front lines of World Wars I and II, today's challenge in Vietnam demands quick assault and rapidity techniques. In this conflict, as in ever, the 1st Infantry Division is serving the United States with honor and distinction, no matter what the sacrifice.
The sounds you hear could come from any jazz tavern in the United States, but instead, they were recorded live in Vietnam by members of the 1st Infantry Division. While serving a tour of duty here in Vietnam, our thoughts and efforts are channeled into the various fields that make up the armed forces. Since everyone dresses in the same uniform and works together for a unified Vietnam, a person's creative talents are often hidden, but never covered completely. The group you're hearing right now are all members of the Big Red One and are playing together for the first time. They've worked professionally before, and upon leaving the service, plan to return to music. Today we take a look at three musicians who have worked in the music profession before coming into the Army. All three have varied tastes in music, and all three share their experiences with us today on Duty First. Joining the Army and the 1st Infantry Division, Specialist Kevin Kelly played on the West Coast with a psychedelic rock group, The Electric Train.
The psychedelic music is quite an experience. I consider that my thing, and it involves getting coordinated with a bunch of other guys, four other guys in the group. We had drums, organ, bass guitar, and a rhythm guitar. The main thing you have to remember in psychedelic music is coordination, because it gives a chance, it's like jazz, it gives a chance for everybody to do their own thing. And sometimes you get quite involved in what from what you're doing, and you have to know a point where everybody can reorganize and get started again.
How did you get your start?
Well, I started when I was about 13 years old. I saved up my money selling Coke bottles or something like this, and got up about 30 bucks and went down to my local five and dime store and bought a $30 Japanese guitar. And I started fiddling around with this, seeing if I could have any fun with it. And I got quite involved in it to the point where I started taking lessons and moved on to bigger equipment and finally the psychedelic stage, which I consider to be one of the ultimate stages.
How is psychedelic music different from the other forms of music?
Well, psychedelic music is quite loose. There's no actual set format that you have to follow. Like, if you're going to do dance band music, you have to play dance band music. People can dance to it. Psychedelic music is more for listening, I believe, than dancing to. So you're quite free in things that you can do. Most psychedelic music, I think, is ad lib or rearrangements of other people's work. There's one group, Deep Purple, that does quite a good job of this.
What is the specialized equipment that makes psychedelic music what it is?
Well, for a lead guitarist, it involves quite a bit of electronic effect equipment, since psychedelic music does consist of a lot of tonal buzzes and things like this. My amplifier alone costs $1,500. It includes, you have vibrato, you have reverb, and you have fuzz tones. And besides this, you have range effects. You can boost your lower range, you can boost your middle range, you can boost your high range. The only accessory aside from my amplifier that I carry is a wah-wah pedal. Now, wah-wah pedal is, it gives it this waddly type effects. It's just like it sounds like wah-wah. You sit there and you play with it, push it up and down, and it just gives it a wah-wah type effect, like Jimi Hendrix uses it quite a bit.
What's going to happen when you get out of the service? Are you going back into music?
Yes, I believe so. I think that's my thing. I, of course, want to get back into it.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ship roll in, then I watch them roll away again. Holding on the lock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay, 'cause I had nothing to live for. Look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, waiting
musical preferences of Lieutenant Forrest Brandt are many. At WBNS in Columbus, Ohio, he had a show format of easy listening and folk music. In earlier days, he was a drummer, and he talks about his past experiences.
Well, we used to have a group that formed a dance band as early as ninth grade, and I played with about three or four different groups. I think the only group that ever got any notoriety was a group called the Juvenile 6 Plus 1, was a Dixieland group that we formed. This was, we had an exposure on the Lawrence Welk show and quite a bit of local TV. At the end of high school, I went on up to Ohio State and played in the marching band there. And if you know anything about marching bands, Ohio State is considered one of the best in the nation and a tremendous amount of spirit.
What type of music do you like to play, and does this have any influence on your personal preferences?
Yeah, I would say that my taste runs to classical music, jazz, folk music, and good rock and roll. I like the Beatles, Mothers of Invention, the Pugs. Those are a few of the rock groups that I care for. But I don't like rock and roll that's just built around the beat. I like rock and roll that's trying to say something. That's why I groove on the Beatles, because
there's so much more there than just a beat. They're telling something.
Where do you think modern music is going? Where is it heading?
Well, obviously, as Kelly has pointed out on some of his shows, it's headed towards the psychedelic, and how far that's going to go, I really couldn't say. There's computer music, if you've heard this yet or not, electronic music that's just made up of the sounds of what's going on around you, the sounds of electrical impulses going through a computer. So the possibilities of music are just fantastic. Wherever man is, whatever man does, has a musical bent to it. It can't be escaped.
Wayne Yeager is the piano player and leader of the group you've been listening to. He talks about his musical experiences both stateside and Vietnam.
I started playing piano when I was about 5 years old. I took about 8 years of classical piano. After that, I kind of went on my own, just learning more from listening than anything else, and I discovered that I liked the jazz idiom for expression and music for my own personal use more than any other.
When your Vietnam tour is completed, do you entertain any thoughts of going further into music?
Yes, I certainly do. That's one of my major concerns right now. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I'm going to go about it. What I'd like to do when I return is, well, first of all, try and recapture what abilities I had before, before my tour in the Army here. At that time, I'd like to try and get together a jazz quartet or quintet. The jazz motif will definitely be the type of music I want to play. Just as to the final details of it all, and that can only work itself out, I think.
In years to come, do you think your Big Red One experiences will have contributed anything to your musical hopes?
Well, I think that any musician who truly tries to be creative in his music can only derive his creativity from his daily experiences. This experience here in Vietnam has, I think, certainly done a lot for me as far as introspection, looking at myself and my life and what I want to do. And in this way, I don't think it can help but have an effect on the primary thing that I intend to do in life, and that is the creating of music.
No matter where he is, the American soldier takes his distinctive music with him. Maybe the only thing he can play is a transistor radio, or maybe, as these men of the Big Red One show, he is a part of American music. For the 1st Infantry Division, I am Army Specialist Bill Johansen.
Duty First, the story of the 1st Infantry Division in Vietnam. Duty First, a presentation to the 1st Infantry Division Information Office in cooperation with the American Forces Vietnam Network.